So welcome to Skype a Scientist Live. Today we're going to be talking all about vaccines with Devika Varma. We're super excited and we'll try to keep this not super depressing in the light of everything going on right now, but we're going to be learning some cool stuff. So other things to know, tomorrow we're going to be talking about marine science that happens in museums. We're having somebody from the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles come tomorrow at 1. Friday, we're going to be hearing about mountains from one of the scientists who participated in our No Time Like the Presentation competition. She's a great speaker. She's really funny. And so normally, you know, rocks don't get me out of bed in the morning, but I could listen to Stacey talk about rocks all day. So you should definitely come on Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern. And then next week, we're going to be talking about elephants and something. Oh, and bugs. So we've got Gwen Pearson coming on. She's got lots and lots of cool bugs that she's going to show us too. So that's going to be really interactive and fun. So you can always sign up to our newsletter so that every weekend you'll get all of the stuff that's happening. I will post that in the Q&A so that you can copy paste that and sign up to our newsletter if you're not already a part of that. And then always know what's up. You can also always find out what's up on our website, skypeascientist.com, and then click live streams. We are a nonprofit organization, a 501c3. So we're pretty much almost all donor supported. We recently got a small grant, hallelujah. So that's great. So we still wanna hire someone. So please, if you can support us, please do so at patreon.com/skypeascientist or paypal.me/skypeascientist. I will stop talking and doing housekeeping stuff now and hand it over to our guest today, Devika.
Hello, everyone. My name is Devika Varma. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm currently working on a new method to deliver vaccines against respiratory viruses through the nose. I work in the Ainslie lab to do this. My background is in biomedical engineering. Most 10 plus years of my life has been spent developing materials, what are called biomaterials, for repairing tissues in the body. And most recently now, I'm using biomaterials to deliver drugs, medicines, or vaccines. So that's a little bit about myself.
Sorry, I muted myself. So when you say biomaterials, are these materials that are being used with biology or that come from biology? Like, what makes a biomaterial a biomaterial?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So essentially, you can look at biomaterials sourced from biological organisms. So this can be sourced from plants. You have cellulose-based materials, many times used in a lot of medicines that we take in our bodies. It can be sourced from shells of animals. So shellfish often are a source for biomaterials like chitosan, which is also used a lot in industry. Biomaterials are sourced from biological organisms. There's also biologically inspired materials where scientists mimic molecules that are found in nature because the body likes those molecules better. So in terms of delivering any kind of drugs or medicines or vaccines into the body or repairing our tissues, it's better liked by our body to use when you use a biomaterial when compared to a synthetic material.
Cool. So basically your body kind of has a sense like, oh, that's a thing that came from a living thing. It feels more like me. I'm generally less likely to get freaked out by it immunologically.
Yeah. So it's immunologically as well as cytotoxicity wise. So you can think of it as, you know, at both those levels. So if you think of it, more naturally sourced material has less toxicity because it has figured out evolutionarily how to coexist with cells, essentially. Right. And so cells don't die in their presence. Whereas, and then the other side is, of course, how do the immune cells react to it? Do they look at it as a foreign body, or are they okay with it? So, and that we can talk about more, especially with respect to vaccines, how that comes into play.
Totally. Cool. So vaccines, we know that we get them in a shot, and over time, they help us not get sick from diseases that exist. But how exactly does a vaccine work?
Yeah. So back when, and it's really cool to think about still, back when Edward Jenner came up with the first vaccine, the idea was he learned that using a weakened form weaker form of the virus can help the body's immune system build the defense mechanisms against that virus. So essentially, back the earlier or the traditional forms of vaccines were weakened forms of the organism or the pathogen itself. As we've progressed and understood this process better, modern vaccines are essentially come under four categories. So these are live attenuated vaccines or inactivated vaccines. So essentially viruses that have been killed by heat or chemicals. Then you can have vaccines that are made of components of the virus. And so what we call antigens. And then you can also use nucleic acids that are coming up a lot, especially with COVID-19. And so those are the essential four classes of vaccines. And so what's most important for a vaccine to work is it needs to have that antigen or some way for the body to be exposed to that antigen. Cool. And so I have a model here that may be good to use at this point. So this is just a virus model and made of styrofoam balls. And what you see here are projections, which essentially could be seen as proteins on the surface of this virus molecule. And some of these molecules may be considered an antigen. So an antigen is a molecule that the body recognizes as a foreign molecule and therefore prepares itself with antibodies against that particular molecule. And so antigen is probably the most important aspect of the vaccine. And based on what type of vaccine of the four types I mentioned, some may need helper molecules. So adjuvants can be considered helper molecules that help the body essentially activate the immune system, and so that it does a better job at recognizing the antigen and creating antibodies against that particular antigen.
Cool. So the adjuvant is something that you add to the vaccine that basically tells the immune system, like, everybody wake up, it's time to pay attention to your surroundings, kind of. Exactly. And then the antigen is kind of like the nasty thing, be it a virus or bacteria or whatever, is kind of like name tag, like, oh, that's that guy, I better attack that guy. The ID.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and that's so awesome. When a virus enters the body process, so there are cells of the immune system that are specialized to capture the virus, engulf it and take it in, and mm-hmm. then essentially it gets chopped up and different particles or molecules of the virus gets tagged as an antigen. And so some are better at creating that immune response while others are not. So what scientists do while studying vaccines is which molecule would be better as an antigen for a particular virus.
Great, cool.
Or a bacteria. It could be any pathogen.
So one of our questions we have from Lila is, can we use vaccines for bacteria or is it just for viruses?
Oh yeah, definitely. So the body is constantly making antibodies against bacteria as well. And so we have several bacterial vaccines available, like DPT, which is a diphtheria tetanus vaccine, or I'm thinking of, BCG against tuberculosis. So those are some examples of vaccines that have been developed against bacteria.
Oh, cool. We've got another question from Roy. Are we close to finding a cure or making a vaccine for coronavirus yet?
I would say in the large scheme of things, we are close. We are close because typically it takes about 5 years to complete the vaccine development process. And we are doing it at a very fast pace right now. Of course, but what I mean by close is that we are two more phases away in terms of the leading vaccine right now being the mRNA vaccine by Moderna. That is just one candidate, right? There are more than 100 vaccine candidates being looked at in different clinical trials. And the reason we've been able to come this far is because before SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, there have been the smaller epidemics that we've seen in the more recent times have really encouraged vaccine development against coronavirus. So I think in the broad scheme of things, we are close to finding one.
Great. Could you take us through like what exactly are the steps from like you've identified a virus and you want to make a vaccine to it to the part where like the general public is getting the vaccine? Like what are the phases? What's that all about?
Yeah, and I'll do that to the best of my knowledge. So I'm more on the development side, but I have an understanding of how this goes. So first identify what are the most potent antigens. Parts of the virus that can be the best at creating that immune response. We do this in animal models first because they are a good platform to understand how the immune system would respond and at least figure out, say you have 10 different antigen types, which of these would be the most potent. You test this out with adjuvants, the helper molecules, and without. So you have a control study done in animals. Once you've picked your potent lead antigens, you move on to the next stage. Now for influenza, which is what my lab works in, there are certain animal models that are better than others. So we do our initial studies in mice, but then we may need to move into ferrets. So ferrets, interestingly, are way better at mimicking the kind of respiratory response we have to respiratory viruses than mice. So for instance, ferrets can sneeze, ferrets have a runny nose. And so you can really be more sure in an animal model, like a ferret model, that this vaccine is working. And what we mean by working is we look at the number of antibodies that's been generated against this particular antigen in the blood at different time points. This would be considered a preclinical stage. And then afterwards, once you feel good about the safety and the immunogenicity of the vaccine, you have three phases of clinical trials. So phase one is when you look at a very healthy population that you feel you're essentially selecting a healthy population to test the safety of this vaccine. And once you see promising results there, promising results would mean what is the smallest dose that can give the best response. So once you identify that, you move on to phase two, where you're actually now treating a larger or testing the vaccine in a larger population in the hundreds. And this would include patients or people of all age ranges of general health conditions that you'd normally see in the population. And then the third phase would be a way larger study where you're looking at thousands of people. And that's a more long-term process because you're now trying to see, does giving the vaccine to this larger population reduce the number of cases you see of the disease in the population? This whole process essentially takes 5 years, and that's the fastest usually.
So we're currently in phase one. Does that mean it's going to take 5 years for Moderna's to get to the end, or are they like fast tracking it in some way?
Yeah, they're definitely fast tracking the Moderna one. Of course, it's contingent on the success at each stage. Right. But the plan is to fast track it. And there are multiple aspects of it that makes it take 5 years versus 18 months. So it's the fact that once you have figured out, typically it's at the end of the second phase, and I don't work in industry, so I'm not fully sure of how it aligns, but you essentially have to start scaling up production. You want to start. So the manufacturing and the scientific aspects have to go kind of parallel right now. So right now we're making it go parallel, but oftentimes it consumes more money to make it go parallel, right? Because you don't really know if something's going to actually work. So why should you scale it up? But we are making it go parallel right now because it's of such urgency.
Right. Awesome. We've got a question from Brian. He asks, are viruses living organisms?
That's a very good question. So viruses are by themselves not living organisms because they need to be inside a cell that's living to replicate, to make copies of itself. So in that sense, it's not a living organism by itself. So it's essentially got a capsid, and inside it has the nucleic acid or the genetic material that encodes all its proteins. And but again, without another living cell, it cannot function. And so for that reason, wouldn't be considered a living organism.
Right. Cool. Let's see. So Elena would like to know, how would you say that you use your engineering background in your job?
Yeah, that's a really cool question. So I, as a biomedical engineer, have been working on creating materials for different applications based on the disease area. So engineering is essentially designing a product, a platform, a technology based on the problem you're trying to solve. So the way, for instance, I can talk about what I'm working on right now, we are currently looking at an intranasal vaccine. So can we deliver a vaccine against a respiratory virus through the nose? And to do that, we first look at the design criteria. So I have to, for that reason, look at who is my end user, right? So if it's a human, and a human nose is what I have to picture in mind. But then I also need to think about what are my animal models. So there are different design criteria that I have to keep in mind while looking at what materials can I use to implement this. And so that's a little glimpse of how I use engineering to do my job right now.
Cool, that's awesome. Let's see, Greta would like to know, how do you pick which antigen affects the body the most? So you can work on making a vaccine with that antigen.
So is the question if we can make a vaccine without an antigen?
How do you, like, of all of the potential antigens on the surface of a virus, like, how do you pick which one is going to be the one?
Yeah. So, every vaccine development process has both in vitro steps as well as in vivo steps. So in vivo work, or work done inside the body of animals or humans, is most informative because we have a complete immune system. But before we get into the animal or the human body, we need to see how cells on a plate or on a dish will respond to these antigens. But I'm going to move further, like talk about the animal model, because that's the most informative stage. And so we typically would identify, so there's a lot of collaboration that happens between scientists who actually study the virus itself and identify what the surface molecules even are, what the structure is. On the other side are scientists who are actually developing the vaccine itself. So there's a lot of collaboration that happens. So based on some of those papers that show what are the different proteins even present on the surface, you take those proteins and you compare them to each other in an animal model. And the results that you're looking for, or the responses you're looking for, is the antibody generation against these specific antigens that you've chosen to explore. You want to produce multiple, you want to see multiple responses. So one is your total, and so there are different types of antibodies called IgG, IgA. These are immunoglobulins, and these are produced by a type of cell called B cells in our body. And so those are the cells, so getting a, to we have good number of tools to actually measure these antibodies in present in our blood. So we would put these antigens, say with a helper molecule like an adjuvant, into the animal, and over time source their blood and actually see how much antibody has been generated against each of these specific antigens. And the number of the successful candidate would have most amount of antibodies generated against it. That's the simplest way of describing how an antibody, how an antigen is chosen at an animal model. Does that answer the question?
Sure, that's great.
Okay.
That's great. Here's a question that might be a little shorter and simpler, but maybe not. I don't know, because immunology is complicated. Can we catch the virus from our pets?
So are we referring to coronavirus?
Yeah.
So right now there is no indication that there is a pet or animal to human transfer of the virus.
Oh, cool. Okay.
They have found the virus in some animals, but it doesn't mean that they can transfer it to humans.
Awesome. Now we've got one about the flu. So how does the flu vaccine get made every year when it comes out before the season has even hit? Is it going between hemispheres? Like how do we know what's going to happen?
Yeah, so the flu vaccine is one. So from my understanding of this, basically companies or different groups are constantly looking at strains of the influenza virus that are changing its structure. So there's constant mutations happening. And so they look at the general prevalence in the population, and based on and the question I think is directed to how do we know beforehand what vaccine to generate, and I think it depends on what is the most prevalent strain that's circulating, and it could be in other parts of the world. So there's a lot of communication that happens between companies, but I'm not the best person to answer anything more about it, about how they come up with the vaccine every year.
Cool, thanks. So how does a scientist make a virus weaker to then put into a vaccine?
So there are many ways to do that. The simplest ways are using heat or certain chemicals. And so what it does it still maintains the structure of the virus, so the body can still see the different antigens present on the virus, but it's not an active virus that can replicate inside the body.
Cool. What happens to the body if we get too many vaccines? Is that even a thing?
That's a very good question. So it really depends on the age of a person, the health status of a person. If you're a healthy individual, you can take multiple vaccine shots, and this can be over your entire age, over your entire lifetime, or within a year, or so. It depends on your health status, really. So if you're immunocompromised or you have some pre-existing conditions, it may be difficult for your immune system to accurately respond to the antigens. But if you're a healthy person, then that may not be as much of an issue. So it's a little difficult to answer how many vaccines can a person get, but have a number for it. But I think from my understanding, that's not a problem.
Great. Okay, good. Let's see. Here's a cool question. How do you get the virus or the bacteria to then make vaccines? Like, where do they come from? How do you get them?
Yeah, so for instance, if you think of COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2, the virus is essentially, you can essentially source the virus from the nasopharynx. So the most common place and most accessible spot is in your nose. Behind your nose is an area called the nasopharynx. And so if you just go in there and take a swab, and if you have an active infection, you can actually get or isolate the virus from there. And then of course, in the lab, you can grow up the virus in little plaques. It's called a plaque forming unit. You can culture those viruses that you isolate from animals or from humans.
Cool. Teddy and Amelia would like to know, how do cells protect themselves from viruses generally?
Yeah, so the body is constantly getting exposed to viruses and bacteria. And so when the body comes in contact with a virus, the immune cells are the ones that they have this property of engulfing the virus and consuming it and breaking it down. And once it gets broken down, what it does is take the portion of the virus or the antigenic molecules of the virus and exhibit it on the outside of the cell. It does this so that other immune cells can recognize this as a foreign molecule. And then the B cells of our immune system does the job of creating antibodies against that specific antigen. So that particular virus has been destroyed by that cell. And then next time you're exposed to the same virus, the body recognizes that antigen that it has created antibodies against. And so the next time it encounters the same virus, it's able to neutralize it. So there are these antibodies called neutralizing antibodies that are essentially able to stop the virus by essentially covering it up with antibodies. So that's cool. How it works.
Sounds good. Rosie would like to know, how many days does it take for a vaccine to take effect?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So if you think of certain vaccines or some vaccines that you get shots for, you need to get boosters. So that's a different area. The question really is, how long does it take for the body to create antibodies? And so that's basically 2 weeks. It takes about 2 weeks for the body to respond to that antigen and create antibodies against it.
Cool. Would our immune system weaken if we rely too much on medicine and shots, et cetera?
If they're referring to vaccines weakening our immune system, then I would say no. I would be of the opinion that vaccines don't really weaken our immune system. We are actually being proactive and exposing it to viruses or other pathogens that it may get exposed to at a future time point. And so it is definitely not weakening our immune system. There are other factors that may be considered weakening of our immune system. So there is a lot of work going on with understanding our gut microbiome. So there are all these bacteria that previous Skype sessions have really gone into. And so use of antibiotics can be one way of potentially weakening our immune system, because and when you take antibiotics, they do kill a large number of your bacteria present in the gut. And these bacteria are known to interact with our own immune system and keep it active and vigilant. And so if those good bacteria aren't around because of the antibiotics you're taking, then that could be one way of weakening your immune system.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, it's tough because sometimes you don't take antibiotics and you end up dying, which obviously is not a good thing, but you don't want to be taking them all the time when you don't really need them. Just listen to your doctor. And
Exactly. And this is definitely this is definitely not me telling you not to take antibiotics.
Right.
But there's different effects of different medications, and so you have to treat it based on what you're suffering from.
Yeah. What the biggest threat is to your life at that moment. Yeah. But your microbiome is super important. So take care of your bacteria whenever you can. Okay, let's see. Oh, this is an interesting question, kind of more of a sociological question. As a vaccine scientist, do you think there's a fundamental reason why people are so quick to believe that vaccines don't work?
Is there a fundamental...
just like why are so many people skeptical that vaccines are going to help them?
I'm actually quite surprised oftentimes when I come across that idea, because I see it more as vaccines are what have kept the human population alive for so long. We used to die by the time we reached 40 to 50 years of age, and a lot of diseases that, like smallpox as a very famous example, were eradicated because of vaccines. And so for me, it's difficult to believe that there are that many people who are finding vaccines to be not useful for humans. But I do think the and I feel like there isn't enough scientific evidence to show that this is weakening or not helping us right now.
Yeah. Generally speaking, vaccines are a beautiful thing for sure. they've saved a lot of lives. So how do viruses get their name?
Viruses, that's a very good question. And I'm not sure how viruses get their name. I know the word vaccine was coined by Edward Jenner. Because, you know, it's coined by Edward Jenner when he was working on the smallpox problem, and he was taking viruses from cows, and so it's called vaccuck as a result. But I'm not sure where the word virus comes from, so I'm gonna look this up after.
We have somebody writing something. I'm gonna put it in the chat, talking about late Middle English, so that's pretty cool. Let's see. I love when our audience has answers that the scientists sometimes don't, when they're like stuff that aren't directly related to their work. That's why I love running these sessions, because I learn so much.
Definitely.
Let's see. Here's a question. Can vaccines be created that prevent multiple illnesses at a time?
So a single vaccine that can prevent multiple diseases?
Yeah.
I think it is a really cool idea. But we haven't gotten there yet. So right now, what we are trying to do is at least create a vaccine that can protect us from multiple strains of, say, influenza, right? So a universal influenza vaccine is at the stage we are getting closer to. If we do get to a point where a single vaccine can prevent multiple, well, actually, let me track back. So for instance, the DPT vaccine is a shot that is protecting us from multiple viruses or multiple pathogens. So it is definitely possible, but the modern vaccines that are using subunit vaccines. So subunit meaning they are only using this antigen molecule and using multiple such antigen molecule of different pathogens. That's definitely possible, but we haven't created, as far as I know, subunit vaccines for multiple pathogens at the same time.
Cool. Let's see. Could you explain more about the RNA of a virus? Maybe if we don't know much about coronavirus or RNA and DNA?
So I want to clarify that question. So more about the RNA of a coronavirus, or what exactly is the question?
Could you explain like what an RNA virus versus a DNA virus is?
Oh yes, of course. So as I mentioned earlier, viruses are very simple. They just have genetic material inside this capsid. And the type of genetic material is what differentiates DNA versus RNA viruses. So DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, whereas RNA is just ribonucleic acid. And so that it's a difference between DNA versus RNA is what makes those viruses different. It obviously would then mean how they act inside our cells would be slightly different as well. So what mechanisms they use would be slightly different to replicate or create more copies of themselves.
Cool. Can immunocompromised or cancer patients get vaccinated?
That's a very good question. And so I think they can get vaccinated, but they have to be working with their doctors and figuring out what the right time point is for them to be able to take these vaccines. So their doctor would be able to tell whether their immune status is one that is strong enough to handle a vaccine. For instance, cancer patients undergo chemotherapy which can last for months. And so maybe during the treatment or soon after the treatment, they are more immunocompromised than at a later point. So maybe at a later point, they are they're stronger to be able to handle a vaccine compared to while they are in a treatment. But I think a doctor would best tell when a cancer patient or an immunocompromised person can take a vaccine.
Great, thanks. Christy would like to know, if you survive coronavirus once, do we know yet if you can get reinfected?
So I would say we don't 100% know, but a lot of the results right now that are being tested in monkeys are showing that we cannot get reinfected. And I am also seeing papers I would say at this point, it's still speculation, but right now scientists are looking at the human population, tracking people who have been infected and seeing if they're getting reinfected. And right now it indicates that we can't get reinfected.
Cool, okay. Let's cross our fingers that turns out to be true. When did you first get interested in vaccines?
Yeah, so this has been more recent. I have been a biomedical engineer focused on biomaterials. And in my previous lifetime, I was working on biomaterials to repair tissues. And I actually had a very life-changing experience when I volunteered for 2 weeks in rural India. And I essentially got really interested in global health since after. And I realized that I wanted to use my biomaterial knowledge to creating solutions for global health. And vaccine development is definitely one of the ways to make a small dent in the problem. So that's how I essentially got interested in working on vaccines.
Cool, sounds good. So we try to keep these sessions to be right around 45 minutes, and we are out of time for regular questions, but we are gonna always wrap these sessions up with the same two questions for everybody. The first question is, what is one thing that you wish everybody in the world knew related to your area of expertise? And then the other question is, what is something that you wish everybody in the world knew related to literally anything? It can be as simple or significant as you'd like.
Okay, so with regards to the first question, as a biomaterials person, I wanna inform or let everyone know that if we just look around ourselves, look into the nature that surrounds us, we'll see that there's something inside them that holds them together, that holds a plant together, that holds a leaf together. I just basically had this leaf next to me to just kind of give an example of what a biomaterial is. But this is not maybe the best example, but if you think of it, if this leaf dries up and if there's a way to kind of remove some of the outer layers, what you see inside is the structure that holds it together. And essentially, we've come really far in creating materials or using materials from nature, but I think we've only scratched the edge. And so if we just look outside and look into the nature that surrounds us and kind of imagine what's holding it in, we may be able to come up with more materials that can be used for important, solving important problems like delivering vaccines or, and there are many useful aspects of why you use a biomaterial to do some of these things. So that's one. And then to answer the second question, I want to, I guess, share that my realization in the last 5 years has been that there is a large divide between the rural and urban populations. So what I'm talking about here is we've advanced so far with the technologies that we've come up with that allows us to understand how the world works around us. How does a virus work? How does it infect us? And we're also using a lot of tools to come up with the most technologically advanced solutions. But what ends up happening, I think, is there's a major gap between the what healthcare access is available in a city versus rural areas in the world. So more than close to 70% of the global population is living in rural areas and don't have access to healthcare. And so I think if scientists, engineers, people who are developing technologies are able to keep that in mind, keep the end user in mind, we can come up with solutions that are more sustainable and affordable earlier than just wait for different pharmaceutical companies or wait for nonprofits to figure out how to bridge that gap. So that's
awesome. Great answers. Perfect. Thank you. Where can we find you online? And is there anything else you want to plug?
Yeah, I can be found on Twitter. My name is Devika M. Varma, and that is also my Twitter handle. So I post a little bit about science and other fun stuff. So would love to see you all there.
Great. Yeah. Sounds good. Thanks so much. Well, thank you for taking the time with us. And thank you, Erin, for signing. Later this week, we've got Marine Science in the Museum tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern. Mountains on Friday, 1 p.m. Eastern, and then Tuesday the 26th, we're going to be talking about elephants at noon Eastern, and then Friday the 29th, we're talking about bugs, and that's also going to be a real good one because she's going to bring bugs for us at 1 p.m. Friday the 29th. These are all in Eastern Standard, or Eastern whatever time we're in right now, daylight time. That's all I have for you. I'm so glad you're all here today, and thank you for all of your questions. If you can support our program, please do. You can do so at patreon.com/skypeascientist. And if you ever have one of these sessions, you're like, wow, I had so much fun, I want to share it with someone else, you can always view sessions afterward at youtube.com/skypeascientist. Devika and Erin, thank you so much for being here with us today, and thanks to the audience, and I'll see y'all later.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.